intentional murder, and I do not wish to seek these charges. And these would not have happened had there not, again, been a tremendous outpouring of support and organizing and advocacy from people, including family members of both Brisha Meadows and Tracy McCarter. But what we're seeing around the country doesn't necessarily play out in the same way. What we've seen in California, there's a case of a woman named Wendy Howard who shot her abusive ex, who had been investigated by police for sexually abusing two of her daughters. And she was acquitted of all charges except for one. And the district attorney has the option of bringing her to trial for that new charge. In the case of Tracy McCarter, the district attorney has said that he does not want to
pursue
these murder charges.
And Vicki, we just have 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. What do you think the judge is going to rule? She said she'll rule by the end of the week, Judge Giesel.
Well, I certainly hope that the judge rules in favor of the motion to dismiss and doesn't waste city resources further punishing a survivor for surviving violence from her husband.
Victoria Lowen, thank you so much for being with us. Journalists who focus on the intersections of incarceration, gender, and resistance will link to your coverage of this case for The Nation. And that does it for our show. A very special happy birthday to Dina Guzder. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, and Ermin Sheff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
It's that time of year again. It's time to support the causes that matter in our lives. It's time to give back to the organizations that give back to our communities all year round. Make KBOO a part of your Giving Tuesday plans and donate today at kboo.fm/give. Or text KBOO to 44321. Help KBOO get a strong start to the end of the year fundraising season on Giving Tuesday, and the impact of your gift will be doubled. That's right, the generous support of KBOO member Jeff Sackett will match your donation this Giving Tuesday, dollar for dollar, up to $5,000. Check KBOO off your Giving Tuesday donation list right now at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-the-year fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, the leader of the far-right group, the Oath Keepers, is convicted of seditious conspiracy for his part in planning the events of January 6th. Oregon lawmakers end the security restrictions on state lawmaker Brian Boquist. And fir trees in Oregon and Washington are dying off in what researchers are calling a firmageddon. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 29th, 2022. I'm Eric Leuschner. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year fundraising drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. The founder of far-right anti-government militia group The Oath Keepers was convicted of seditious conspiracy in federal court today. Stuart Rhodes and four co-defendants were on trial for their work in leading a months-long plot to unleash political violence at the January 6th Capitol insurrection. This is the first time that the federal government has leveled the charge of seditious conspiracy in the massive January 6th investigation. Rhodes and his followers converged on the Capitol in combat gear, staging an arsenal of weapons at nearby hotels. Law professor Randall Eliason told the Washington Post that the outcome is a vindication for the Justice Department. Eliason said, quote, "The jury's verdict on seditious conspiracy confirms that January 6, 2021 was not just legitimate political discourse or a peaceful protest that got out of hand. This was a planned, organized, violent assault on the lawful authority of the U.S. government and the peaceful transfer of power," end quote. The verdict may be a sign of things to come for trials against five other Oath Keepers and the leaders of the far-right group, the Proud Boys. Oregon state lawmaker Brian Boquist will no longer have increased security around when he visits the Oregon Capitol. His fellow lawmakers had imposed restrictions on him, like having to announce his intentions to be at the Capitol within 12 hours' notice, because of threats he made to other lawmakers. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
Oregon lawmakers have removed security measures put in place against State Senator Brian Boquist more than 3 years ago. The measures were enacted after he made threatening statements during the bitter 2019 legislative session. Boquist was required to provide advance written notice before he visited the state capitol, allowing time to increase security in the building. In 2019, Senate Republicans staged a walkout to block a vote on climate change legislation. Boquist, a Republican at the time, made comments to Senate President Peter Courtney that were considered threatening. He said, quote, "I understand the threats from members of the majority that you want to arrest me. You want to put me in jail with the state police and all that sort of stuff, Mr. President. And if you send the state police to get me, hell's coming to visit you personally," end quote. He also allegedly advised the Oregon State Police Superintendent to send well-armed, single officers if they planned on arresting him, in what many took as a threat to kill state troopers if they tried to make him return to the Capitol. Boquist said, quote, "Send bachelors and come heavily armed," end quote. A few weeks after his comments, the Conduct Committee unanimously voted to require 12-hour written notice whenever he would be in the Capitol. The restrictions ended yesterday by a 3-to-1 vote of the Senate Conduct Committee. Committee Chair Floyd Prezansky, Democrat Eugene, said, quote, "I do not believe the interim safety measures are needed to continue to provide a safe workplace for the Legislative Assembly employees and individuals who come to the Capitol for work or other reasons," end quote. Boquist told the committee that he didn't believe it had authority to impose restrictions in the first place, let alone remove them. The vote came amidst an ongoing federal lawsuit Boquist filed against several senators, including Prezansky, alleging they violated his First Amendment rights to speech and assembly. The complaint says the restriction interferes with his ability to meet on short notice with constituents, elected officials, and others at the Capitol. State police and private contractors provide security in the building, which houses the legislature and the governor's office. Boquist had also objected to the increased police presence whenever he was there. The defendants maintained that they had good reason to take those actions against Boquist and that they should be protected from judgment because of legislative immunity. In court filings, Boquist denied his statements were threats, saying he was engaged in political gamesmanship. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Fir trees are dying at an alarming rate in Oregon and Washington this year in an event researchers are calling Firmageddon. It doesn't have just one cause, but many compounding factors. Researchers have pointed to last year's heat dome, drought, insects, and fungal disease. The research from the U.S. Forest Service hasn't been released yet, but they found fir die-offs happening in nearly 2,000 square miles of forest in Oregon and Washington. Oregon was hardest hit, with this year's numbers for die-off nearly double any other numbers previously recorded. The most heavily affected forests were the Fremont, Winnemah, Ochaco, and Malheur National Forests. The space taken up by Firmageddon isn't as noticeable as the number of dead trees in that space. In some places, as much as 50% of fir trees have died. Drought and heat waves have made fir trees weaker and more susceptible to insects and fungal diseases. The U.S. Drought Monitor estimates that Oregon and Washington have been in some form of drought the early 2000s. As the end of 2022 approaches, this means it's almost time for people to file their income tax returns. A free program in King County is looking for volunteers to assist. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
It may seem early, but programs across the country are preparing to help people with their 2022 income tax returns. In Washington State, United Way of King County is calling for volunteers for its free tax preparation program. Ryan McFerrin, who runs the organization's tax program, says they rely on hundreds of volunteers each year. He says there are a couple of different volunteer roles, including tax preparers who get to serve people directly.
In most cases, they get to tell those people that they're going to be receiving some money as form of a tax refund and other financial assistance, which is typically pretty rewarding for volunteers.
McFerrin says the program will be offered on-site and virtually. He says people don't need tax prep experience to volunteer. there will be 5 training opportunities, with the first one happening this weekend and the last in mid-January. The program also is looking for community intake specialists who will assist at tax sites. McFerrin says when they file their income taxes, low- and middle-income families are eligible for the Earned Income Tax Credit, which he sees as one of the federal government's most vital anti-poverty programs.
Taxes are actually a really great way to access the cash that they may need in order to cover their basic expenses, put a little bit more food on the table. Maybe they have a overdue utility bill that they need to pay.
He also notes that the Working Families Tax Credit will be widely available to families in Washington state. Eligible families include folks who are undocumented. He says people looking to apply for the credit should visit a tax preparation site. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Multnomah County leaders are considering a ban on the sale of flavored tobacco products like mentholated cigarettes, e-cigarettes, hookah products, and other flavored nicotine products. This is despite the fact that a similar ban was overturned in Washington County in September. The judge reasoned that a ban like that would have to come from the state level. County leaders are scheduled to vote Thursday. Leaders have pointed to studies that showed flavored e-cigarettes were the most commonly used tobacco products for middle and high school students. They also pointed to other studies that show that policies like a ban on flavored tobacco products have been effective in other places by keeping young people from becoming addicted to nicotine. Public Health Director Jessica Guernsey points out that tobacco companies market their mentholated and flavored products specifically to Black, Latin, and Native American residents. Guernsey said, quote, "The restricted sale of flavored tobacco, including menthol, directly ties to what it means to address racism as a public health crisis," end quote. If the ban passes, it won't punish people for using flavored tobacco products. Since it's a public health law, it would be up to public health officers to enforce the ban by monitoring retail sales and holding shopkeepers accountable if they sell the banned products. Georgia breaks a state record for early voting. Democrats are one step closer to codifying same-sex marriage, and Arizona county officials refuse to certify the results of the midterm elections. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
This is now the fifth time my name has been on the ballot in less than 2 years for the same doggone job.
Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia says he has proven to voters just how much he wants to win the December 6th Senate runoff election against his opponent, Republican Herschel Walker. Voters in Georgia broke a state record for a single day of early voting, casting nearly 250,000 votes. Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut says Senate Democrats currently don't have the 60 votes needed to advance an assault weapons ban bill, but a win in Georgia's Senate runoff election could change that. Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says President Joe Biden was only referring to assault weapons when he called on Congress over the weekend to pass a ban on high-powered guns.
We understand it's an uphill battle. We understand that this is not easy. He gets that, but doesn't mean that he's going to stop fighting for it or that he's going to stop talking about it.
President Biden is also urging Congress to pass legislation to intervene and block a nationwide railroad strike, which he says would shut down many American industries. 4 rail unions are negotiating new contracts after a tentative agreement was rejected. Biden says there appears to be no path to resolve the dispute at the bargaining table. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, the first openly gay person to serve in the U.S. Senate, is celebrating the passage of another procedural step to strengthen protections for same-sex and interracial marriages.
Certainly throughout the American public, the acceptance of marriage equality, the belief that one ought to be able to marry and protect the person they love, is now, I would say, almost overwhelmingly supported.
The Respect for Marriage Act would guarantee federal recognition of any marriage between two individuals if the union was valid in the state where it was performed. It would also require states to accept the legitimacy of a valid marriage performed elsewhere.
I mean, what they did in 2020, it looks like they've done that again and then some. And for the governor, if he says he's going to certify this and Katie Hobbs to certify this, I think they really better think long and hard.
Officials in Cochise County, Arizona, have voted to delay certifying results from this month's midterm elections, as former Republican gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake repeats unfounded claims that voters were disenfranchised. County officials missed the state's legal certification deadline of Monday, a move that is expected to bring immediate legal challenges. Finally, Republican Senators Bill Cassidy, Susan Collins, and John Thune are a rarity in their party for criticizing former President Donald Trump for hosting a well-known white nationalist for dinner at his Mar-a-Lago estate. Trump says he was unaware of who was coming to dinner. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to an end-of-the-year fund drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during the program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 33. Warming shelters are open. Residents are advised to call 211 for more information. Tomorrow, the rain continues with a high of 45. Today in history, in 1972, Atari releases Pong, the first commercially successful video game. The quote of the day is from American actor Don Cheadle, who was born today in 1964. He said, quote, "Living by example, that's always a better teacher than trying to preach." More than $6 million in American Rescue Plan Act funding will jumpstart the creation of a network in Ohio to connect domestic violence survivors with healthcare providers, with a focus on treating traumatic brain injury, and will provide additional emergency shelter. As Nadia Ramlagan reports, Ohio suffered 112 domestic violence fatalities in the year ending June 30.
A new statewide initiative aims to help connect domestic violence survivors with medical providers, with a focus on treating traumatic brain injury. Rachel Ramirez founded the Ohio Domestic Violence Network's Center on Partner-Inflicted Brain Injury. She says survivors often experience severe violence aimed at the head, neck, and face. But there's been a long-standing gap in accessing the right medical services when individuals come into shelters. She says a portion of the initiative's more than $6 million in funding will be used to pay for treatment.
To pay for health care that people are not able to get reimbursed through other means, through Medicaid or insurance. We want to investigate the possibilities of working with occupational therapy to help with some of the brain injury rehabilitation.
The 3-year project, in collaboration with the Ohio Association of Community Health Centers, will cover 4 to 6 areas of the state. According to data from the Ohio Domestic Violence Network, the state suffered 112 domestic violence-related fatalities between June 2021 and June 2022. More than 20 of those deaths were children. Ramirez says advocates also are working on developing a statewide virtual and call-in center known as the Care Health Connection.
That will be a place where domestic violence programs and survivors can also talk to an advocate when they have health-related needs to help them get better connected to either telehealth services, behavioral health services, or other health services in their community.
Emily Culo is Director of Mobile Advocacy and Meaningful Access at the Ohio Domestic Violence Network. She says the goal is to eliminate barriers that prevent survivors from seeking help, and then providing a holistic approach once a connection has been made.
So checking in with the survivor about what's going on with their housing, what's going on with their health care, when was the last time they were even seen by a doctor.
According to the National Center for Health Research, women who experience domestic abuse are more likely to suffer from diabetes, asthma, lower back pain, headaches, and other chronic conditions. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Ohio News Connection.
A teen school board member in Boise wants to expand climate change curriculum for students. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Shiva Rajbhandari is a high school senior in Boise, Idaho, and in September, he was elected to the Boise Board of Education.
Students are the primary stakeholders in our education.
So Rajbhandari says young people's perspectives on their education matter, and one of the topics he and other students want to learn more about is climate change. He says he was introduced to climate change in his 7th grade science class. That's more than students get in many other schools, but he says it's not enough. Raj Bhandari wants to see the topic taught at all grade levels, starting in kindergarten, where teachers can establish basic concepts about caring for the Earth. And he says it should appear across the curriculum.
Climate change doesn't just apply to science, so why are we only teaching it in science, right? Climate change has connections with English, with social studies, with history, with humanities.
Social studies classes could study policies to reduce carbon pollution, and math students could learn about probabilities using data on climate impacts.
If schools are supposed to prepare us to be the leaders of the future, we need to know about the problems of today.
So he ran for office to make sure that when leaders make decisions about teaching climate change and other important issues, a student voice is at the table. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
An Alaska judge has ruled in favor of the tribal sovereignty of the Tanuna Chiefs Conference. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Alaska Superior Court has dismissed a suit challenging Tanuna Chiefs Conference tribal sovereign immunity, a status which protects it from being sued. A November 21st order issued by Judge Patricia Haynes threw out a case filed by Dot Lake Village, which alleged TCC bylaw violations like illegal board meetings and votes, and sought court intervention to prevent them from happening again. Dot Lake argued that the sovereign immunity of TCC tribes does not extend to the Interior Alaska Native Service Organization. But the court found that TCC is an arm of its member tribes and therefore cannot be sued by them, adding that the court, quote, lacks jurisdiction to insert itself in a dispute that ultimately boils down to a self-governance disagreement with an intertribal consortium, unquote. In an emailed response to a request for comment, Dot Lake Village President Tracy Charles Smith said, TCC is not a tribe but is asserting tribal rights without getting the consent of its member tribes. In so doing, TCC is claiming that it may violate its governing rules without consequence. TCC did not respond to an interview request by KUAC, but in a press release announcing the case dismissal, TCC Chief and Chairman Brian Ridley says they're ready to move past these issues and have worked hard over the past year to heal the organization and continue to move forward with strength, unity, and respect. A new study shows that a wide variety of Arctic animals, including polar bears, are being exposed to a tick-borne disease normally associated with rabbits and hares. The Alaska Beacon, an online journal, reported the findings. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted the study to look for signs of exposure to the bacterium that causes tularemia, also known as rabbit fever. The research is designed to help scientists track diseases as the Arctic warms and they spread north. Alaska Native people could be the first to feel its impacts if tularemia spreads to the animals they hunt. Arctic foxes and Arctic ground squirrels showed the highest levels of antibodies in the blood to fight it. Caribou showed the lowest levels. Polar bears were in the middle. Geese examined in the project also showed exposure. Antibodies to the bacterium do not necessarily mean the animals had tularemia, only that they were exposed to it. It's rare for the disease to spread to humans, although some cases have been documented in Alaska. According to the CDC, some of the symptoms are skin ulcers, sore throats, and in the most serious cases, pneumonia-like coughs, chest pain, and breathing difficulties. A Native American writer and actor for the Peacock series Rutherford Falls says while it's disappointing the show was not picked up for a third season, Indigenous representation in popular media is still strong. Here's Janice Schmieding.
There tend to be elimination of newer shows, shows that don't have as many viewers, and I think Rutherford Falls is possibly a victim of some larger shifts that are happening in the industry and that we're seeing with other shows as well.
Schmieding adds many writers and performers with Rutherford Falls are already involved with other productions. She's continuing work with another Native theme series, Reservation Dogs, which has been renewed for a third season. President Biden will host the White House Tribal Nations Summit Wednesday and Thursday at the Department of the Interior in Washington, D.C. The summit provides an opportunity for tribal leaders from the 574 federally recognized tribes to engage with the federal government. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
the first in-person summit between President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping found some points of agreement. Both sides rejected the idea of a new Cold War and the possibility of nuclear war. But there were disagreements, too, at the summit in Bali. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Thanks and hello, everyone. The much ballyhooed first in-person summit between Presidents Biden and Xi went off pretty well in Bali. Biden clearly communicated the U.S. belief that a new Cold War will not happen, that the U.S. is not looking for conflict with China, and that the U.S. does not expect China to invade Taiwan. For his part, Xi reiterated the long-standing Chinese position that Taiwan is a core interest and that stability in the Taiwan Strait is incompatible with Taiwan's independence, which is China's red line. He agreed with Biden, echoing Ronald Reagan, that nuclear war must never be fought and can never be won, a clear rejection of possible Russian use of a nuclear weapon in Ukraine. And Xi reiterated what he has said to Biden about cooperation at various virtual meetings. Quote, it is in our mutual interest to benefit from each other's development. It is also in our mutual interest to promote post-COVID global recovery, tackle climate change, and resolve regional issues through U.S.-China coordination and cooperation. The two sides need to respect each other, pursue mutual benefit, focus on the larger picture, and nurture a sound atmosphere and stable relations for cooperation. He and Biden agreed to form joint working groups on climate change and other issues. There was also disagreement. Xi rejected Biden's division of the world into autocracies and democracies, saying, quote, the so-called democracy versus authoritarianism narrative is not the defining feature of today's world. Still less does it represent the trend of the times. Xi also challenged the prevailing U.S. view that China is a threat to the U.S. political system or its primacy in the international order. Quote, China has never sought to change the existing international order, does not interfere in the internal affairs of the United States, and has no intention to challenge or replace the United States. That last point deserves further discussion because I think it is central to U.S.-China differences and might very well be the obstacle that keeps the Bali meeting from becoming the jump-off point for a new era of U.S.-China engagement. What I believe Xi is trying to convey to Biden is that the two countries have very different understandings of national security. While the U.S. view has always been outward-looking, seeing national security as dependent on international security, China looks at national security from the inside out. As Xi explained last year, national security is political security, and political security is regime security, that is, the security of the Chinese Communist Party state. Xi said at Bali, quote, leadership of the Chinese Communist Party and China's socialist system have the support of 1.4 billion people. They are the fundamental guarantee for China's development and stability. For China and the U.S. to get along, it is vital to recognize and respect such difference. When Xi told Biden that neither side should seek to change the other system, he was warning against U.S. interference, as he saw it, in Chinese society. Repression of human rights, in other words, in its economic development by decoupling the two economies, its building of security coalitions directed at China, and of course Chinese claims of sovereignty over Taiwan. Given current U.S. policies on those four issues and the Republican Party's announced intention to further harden U.S. policy on China, the Bali spirit may not prevail for long. With strong support from the bipartisan consensus on China in Congress, the Biden administration is doing precisely what Xi warned against. It is pressing China on repression in Xinjiang, Hong Kong, and dissent in general. It is barring China from access to advanced computer chip and supercomputer technology. It has formed or revised security groups, AUKUS, and the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue to address the China threat. And it is strengthening ties with Taiwan, both politically and militarily. Viewed from Beijing, a new Cold War and U.S. containment of China looked to again be the cornerstones of American policy. Xi warned Biden that containment will not succeed against China. Xi also said at Bali, quote, neither side should try to remold the other in one's own image or seek to change or even subvert the other's system. Instead of talking in one way and acting in another, the U.S. needs to honor its commitments with concrete action. That statement is a direct response to the China threat school that now predominates here. The Biden administration should test Xi's position and hold open the possibility of re-examining the premises of its current China policy. I'm Mel Gertov for the Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to an end-of-the-year fund drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 29th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonio Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Nadia Ramlagan. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fund drive, so now is a great time to get involved. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for listening. On the heels of the midterm elections, West Virginia is seeing a populist surge. West Virginia Can't Wait is a movement to end corporate money in local politics. It saw big midterm election gains in Charleston. The organization ran an 18-month campaign to listen to voters, built a city-specific platform,